C.S. Lewis said, you reread books not because the books change, but because you do. You go back in and you're like, oh, I'm seeing this differently because I'm different.
Run your home and your dough like a biblical boss.
To those of you joining us, which is really all of you, because we just started this podcast seconds ago.
So wait, to those of you joining us.
To those of you not joining us, we have nothing to say, but to
not a word.
I'd like to welcome Jeff Davenport, common guest, uncommon man, but frequent guest, I should say.
It's been a while, though.
Here on the Abraham's Wallet podcast, Jeff and I have been doing this particular Abe's Wallet tradition now, I think, since 2022.
I think since the dawn of books.
Yep. Since humanity emerged from the last great plague. That year was a year that I think I read a whole lot because I was having insomnia. So I had like 50 books to review with you guys. And we've gotten a little bit more efficient at this. But Jeff, welcome to the podcast. How are you feeling about your 2024 reading? How was it?
It was unique. This year, I decided to limit myself to 17th century French political pamphlets. So that's all I read. And doggone it, I don't speak French.
My favorite thing about political pamphlets from the 17th century, and this is not even, I'm not making this up. They would write like 250 pages of political theory and hand it out as a pamphlet. And that's all you need to know about how far we've fallen in our attention span as a human race is that now, if it's more than 15 seconds on TikTok, the youth aren't interested. I'm just going to say before we get into the books, the reason that we do this on Abraham's Wallet is because we are all about helping you build up wealth, not just in your bank account, in your financial capital, but in all five capitals. So we think of five different possible capitals as financial, intellectual, physical, relational, and spiritual, in that order of importance, spiritual being the most. And probably the one that we talk about the least is intellectual. And I think that reading books is one of the best ways to expand your intellectual capital, especially for most of our listeners who are in the busy parenting, working phase of life where you're not necessarily in a spot to go enroll in courses at your community college or even do, you know, Donald Trump's free online university or anything like that. You have to kind of find intellectual capital and fit it into the spaces that you can. And so reading is a great way to do that. So we just want to encourage you to read. And you don't have to read the books Jeff and I liked, but for some of you, you said, I always pick up one or two of these books, and to me, that's a win. So that's why we do it.
Do you just have in your home somewhere a giant bookcase full of all these red books, or do you do something else with them?
Giant. We have one whole wall, and we just got another whole wall of bookshelves installed in a room that we renovated because I like to have these books on hand, and two of the six books I'm going to talk about today are out on loan right now. So I like to think it's a blessing to our community and not just trophies of our intellectual achievement.
Yeah. Mark, you like to give and then you give a little more. And then when you've given, you're like, I think there's still room to give. I can loan this book out as well.
Yep. And they're trophies of my intellectual achievement.
Well, of course. Yeah. I'm a little surprised they're not behind you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's get into it because I've got a lot to share. I'm going to start with a quick hit. In the past, we did quick hits in longer form. You said you don't have many quick hits, so I have just a couple.
Okay.
One of your favorite topics, Jeff, The Lust of the Flesh by Jared Moore. So this book, I just picked up Jared Moore. I think I found him on Twitter. And if you want a really thorough explication of what the Bible has to say on the topic of sexual morals. That's not just so obscurely theoretical, but also not popcorn. Like Jared Moore does a really good job of drilling all the way down in the Bible and then finding here is the arguments you will hear, whether it's from kind of progressive Christians. He really goes after, like, there's people who are claiming Christ who are going to tell you that this is actually what the Bible says. And they'll cite translation issues and things like that. This book is really good at that. I handed it to my oldest daughter because I just think he addresses a lot of the topics that are harder, I think, for a modern Christian to know the right apologetics for when those things come under attack. So quick read. It's only, what is it? It's about 150 pages, so it's a quick read. I always have a book like this on my list. Last year, it was The Mortification of Sin, which I actually bought a copy of that book for all the gentlemen who came on our Abraham's Wallet retreat and handed them a copy because I liked it so much. So if you come on an Abe's Wallet retreat, you're probably going to get a present from me.
It's probably going to be a book.
Anyways.
Hey, real quick. Okay, so this just makes me so proud of my nephew. He asked for a book for Christmas. I had forgotten that that was the book that you had recommended. So for Christmas, I got him this book, The Mortification of Sin. He opens it on Christmas. He's so excited about this book. I'm like, what kind of 21-year-old is this that he's so geeked up about reading The Mortification of Sin?
A smart one who listens maybe to the Abraham's Wallet podcast. Who knows?
Maybe that's why. That's right.
Okay, what you got, Jeff?
Well, do you want to do another quick hit?
Sure. This is one that I was just perusing the bookshelves, and I think I had just finished one of the books we're going to talk about today, which I'll tell you, I had a year of heavy books, thick, like 2 pages every 10 minutes instead of quick reads. And I told my wife, I just want a palate cleanser. What do you got? And she gave me this book by Ira Levin, The Boys from Brazil.
Yeah, what do you think?
Fun. Just a fun story where it's kind of there's a big twist. If you're paying attention, you can kind of see the twist coming. It's not a total surprise, but kind of a book that contemplates an alternate world in which the Nazi Party succeeded in World War II in ways that meant they were still around much later on. And what's happening and what are they trying to do to regain power in the 70s? So
are they the bad guys or are they the good guys?
They're the bad guys.
I think we just need to clarify that.
Boys from Brazil, good book. I can't tell you too much about the plot without giving it away. I'll just call it a quick hit, fun read.
There's a movie of it with Gregory Peck.
I heard the movie wasn't very good, but...
Haven't seen it.
Okay.
I'll read that book, though. I'm excited. All right, here's mine. I've always been fascinated by the true life story I'm about to share with you, viewers and listeners. And I think there are a number of books about this topic. But somehow, and I can't remember how, I stumbled onto basically a self-published book by this lawyer who was so passionate about this topic that he wrote his own book and self-published it and self-promotes it. It is called A Pumpkin Patch, A Typewriter, and Richard Nixon. A Pumpkin Patch, A Typewriter, and Richard Nixon by John Beresford. Beresford is a retired attorney and law professor who lives out in Arlington, Virginia. He had majored in Russian. Just one of these really smart guys who loved the topic of the what you would call the Hiss Chambers case. The Hiss Chambers case was one of the most famous communist spy cases in U.S. history. It took place over primarily the 1950s, the end of the 40s and into the 50s. So this guy, I'm going to call it the end-all be-all work around this story. This is a fascinating story. Allow me to tempt your tummy with the taste of nuts and honey coming from A Pumpkin Patch, A Typewriter, and Richard Nixon. This is the real story of this guy, Whitaker Chambers, who was a communist who lived in America. He had bought into communism. And then he started to have his life changed. He really became a believer. I love this little bit. He became a believer in God. He moved from atheist to Christian because he had given, his wife had given birth to their little daughter, and he was staring at her ear. And he said, there's got to be a creator who made this. So this guy went full believer, dropped communism, is like, this is for the birds. And became a well-known author, a writer, and was one of the editors at Time Magazine. Well, he's like, okay, communism behind me. I'm done. That's fine. Well, he started to watch the ascendancy of this very erudite, very smart, well-heeled, Ivy League type guy, Alger Hiss. And he's like, I knew that guy. That guy was a raving communist, and he's acting like he never was. And so Chambers tells HUAC, House Un-American Activities Committee, that Hiss not only is a communist, he was a spy. And so this all played out writ large in America, Hiss against Chambers. And right in the middle was Richard Nixon, who was a young senator. It's a wonderful story. It's an amazing story. If you have any sort of legal bend, this guy takes a lot of it from a legal perspective. It's a great read. You can also listen to it for free. This wonderful man, John Beresford, has put it up on Apple Podcasts or Podcasts. You can listen to each chapter as an episode. It's a fascinating story. I loved it. Great book. Way to go, John Beresford.
Wow. That sounds really fun. And I don't know, apropos to the current fact that it seems like Washington, D.C. has multiple threads that are being pulled that might unwind similar stories of people who aren't exactly who they say they are. Maybe they've just kind of fit themselves in the mold. So that's interesting. Okay, I'll give you my first Chewy book. This is, I think, was it the first? I think it was the first book I read in 2024. And very popular book. You've probably read it, Jeff. Have you read The Fountainhead by Ayn Rand?
No.
Okay. Well, I'd always sort of looked at the length of the book, and I read Atlas Shrugged up until the point where it entered the 150-page political ranty diatribe, and I just put it down and said, I can't do this anymore. So I was kind of down on it, but my wife kept saying, you would love this. And boy, howdy, I loved it. And The Fountainhead is the story of an architect in New York City who is a genius. He gets kicked out of architecture school because he will not conform to the kind of what he thinks of as everybody's just copying things and sort of patching together ugly stuff because it's what the client wants. And so if you work in any sort of service or creative, or I think the thing about this book that I liked so much is that they really talk about business and industry as a creative endeavor. I just love the character in this book because he's uncompromising all the way down to the bedrock layer of who he is, meaning that he, at one point in the book, these other architects who are just willing to do whatever people ask them to do keep getting hired and nobody wants to hire him. And he ends up working in a stone quarry as a laborer and says, I would rather do this for minimum wage than build the ugly monstrosities that are not true to who I am. And eventually he kind of does enough to be recognized for his genius, but is always and constantly from the first to the last of the book willing to just say, I will only do what I want to do. Now, I don't think that's the way we are called to live our lives as followers of Christ. So I'm not saying that he is my personal example for how you do things, but there is a component of his attitude that I just think is really pure. And it feels like it could have been written this year because there's so many voices around him saying, well, just compromise a little bit. If you'll say the thing or do the thing that you know isn't exactly true, but it helps everyone get along. And he's like, I won't lie. And that's kind of how he portrays being willing to retrade on his art. I won't lie at all, ever. And if it costs me all of this massive wealth I've built up, I don't care at all. I'm fine with it. And so it's a really fun book. And if you need just sort of, I think, an encouragement to be more bold in your convictions, this book is fiction that can do that for you.
It makes me think of three things. One of Jordan Peterson's rules of life is like, don't ever lie. Always be, he's not just talking about being an honest person, but like, don't compromise. And so it sounds like that's there. Two, I saw a movie. I can't fully recommend this movie called The Brutalist. It's up for Best Picture next year or this year. And there has a lot of overlap there. This idea of an architect who, no matter what, won't give up on his morals about building. And I'm not going to do that because that's a dumb thing. I'd rather end up taking another job than do this thing.
Right.
And I think third, you know, there's something to the idea of us as believers. I'm sure this isn't really a believer book, but us as believers looking at our lives and going, we're playing with house money. Like, we don't have to freak out about every little, what compromise will I make so that I can, I feel like as believers, we're meant to walk around this world going, I'm going to do what's right. And if I do what's right, it is biblical that God will take care of me.
Yes. Yeah. All of that. That's why I liked it.
Great. I'll read it. Fun. All right. My next book is, I feel like once a year at least, I'm reading a C.S. Lewis book or rereading a C.S. Lewis book. And this C.S. Lewis book this year is called Till We Have Faces. I had read Till We Have Faces, I want to say probably 10 years ago, and I had vague memories of it. And I remember feeling like, okay, it's an interesting book. It's an odd one. It's fiction. It's the retelling of the myth of Cupid and Psyche, which right there should get everybody, you know, beating a hasty path to Amazon to buy the book. But I didn't remember enjoying it. I remember reading it and like, okay, well, I did that. This book is just great. This is a great book. Have you read this, pal?
No.
Okay. If you come at it going, oh, he's going to do a retelling of Cupid and Psyche, like it says all over the back of the book, don't think that. Think I'm reading a story from another world to some degree. It's like this Middle Ages kind of story about, I won't go into too many details, but it's about this woman who's starting to become basically the queen of this land, but she's very ugly. And this book, it's very much in line with a lot of the themes that Lewis comes back to in my favorite Lewis book, which is The Great Divorce. And it's about the nature of love, how the dark side of love is control. There's a lot of him exposing what we think of as love between this woman and basically her sister that isn't really love. It's actually a lot of control and hatred. There is a big theme of faith versus sight. There's a big theme of putting up a front in front of, quote unquote, the gods. Towards the end of the book, I won't spoil anything, but I'll say this. The book is broken into two parts. It's not two halves. It's two parts, part one and part two. When you finish part one, you're like, all right, this is great. Let me just warn you, the beginning of part two is a bit of a slog. And I told my wife, because she read the book after I said, don't give up here, because if you'll go through the beginning of part two, you're going to get some good payoff here. And the payoff here has to do with her basically writing a letter to the gods, who is clearly God, and going, how dare you? How dare you? How dare you? And the gods speak to her. To some degree, that part is really a retelling of Job.
Yeah, exactly what I thought of.
Oh, this book, you don't know where it's going. It keeps you in a good level of mystery. If you just stick with it all the way to the end, if I remember correctly, I think Lewis would have said that this was one of his favorite books that he wrote. Fabulous book.
How long is it, Jeff?
If I had to guess, I'd bet like 230 or so.
Okay, so it's not a long book.
No, it's not huge.
Okay.
It's not huge at all. And it is a story. Like, you're reading a story. It's not like there's no 150-page. Let me tell you about the nature of sin.
Right, right. Okay, because when you said there's a slog, I'm like, okay, are we talking a 3-week slog or one evening slog?
No, the story has such momentum, and then you're like, okay, I get it. She's miserable.
Yeah.
But if, again, stick with it, you'll get to a good spot.
Got it. Yeah, The Fountainhead is 753 pages. The next book I'm going to talk about, let's see, I actually don't know how many pages this one is. 752, although the one I read is 1,072. So it was a year of long books. So the next one I read again, I read this book first when I was a senior in high school, and I had this literature teacher who really was probably the best teacher I ever had, including Princeton, all those professors, some of whom were geniuses. This high school teacher was probably the best teacher I ever had. His name was Bill Bradley. He kind of mentored me through this. We each had to write a research paper on a book. And at the time, it felt like it was the longest paper we could even imagine. I think it had to be at least 20 pages. So it was a long-ish paper for a high schooler. That was part of graduating from our school. And I wrote mine on Theodore.
Let's sit on Bill for a minute. Tell me more about Bill. Like, why was he awesome?
I think he legitimately got fired up about everything he taught. He taught me for 2 years. So at our school, they combined history and English, or history and literature. So it was one class, and it wasn't like, okay, put your book away and let's open the history book. We learned history through literature. And it started freshman year with the Epic of Gilgamesh. This is as far back as we have text. And we went all the way up to modern times. And so I just think it was such a fun class to, like, you know, dig your teeth into how people were thinking at this time through art and through wars and through the books they wrote and the poems they wrote. It was just really an effective class. And I liked Mr. Bradley so much that a few of us would meet with him at lunch once a week, and we would do a book club and read something else and just say, you're so passionate about this stuff that we just want you to go. Like, pick a book that you're stoked on and let's do it. And he was just a really impressive guy. Elder in the church type guy. Took care of his wife, who was bedridden for years and years with a terminal disease and eventually passed away. But, like, just never complained, even though I think his life probably, there was plenty of reasons he might have had very justifiable complaints, but just a guy of really high character who seems to look at great literature and understand God better because of the stories he was reading.
Let's hear it for Bill Bradley. Like, yeah, these are the guys that we want surrounding our children, who have such a passion for life, the Lord, the fullness of life, and also understand, this idea that history isn't over here and literature isn't over here and this is over here. I mean, it sounds to me like this guy, there was already maybe a spark in you, but flamed big time, this idea that, gosh, there's a holistic view of things.
For sure.
Anyway, wow, way to go, Bill Bradley.
So Bill, who was already in his late 50s when I was in his class, he just retired a year or two ago. Him and another teacher at the school both loved the book I'm going to talk about, which was The Brothers Karamazov by Fyodor Dostoevsky. And so I read it as a senior, and I remember these guys put their arms on my shoulder and said, you must read this book 3 times in your life, at least. Once as a young man, once as a father, and once as a grandfather. And that it will have a totally different meaning to you each of those times. And so I kind of have, it's a long book. Like I said, it's 1,000 pages in the version I have. And I totally agree with that assessment. As a young man, I read it, and it's the story of these 3 brothers and their father, who's an alcoholic philanderer. And the 3 brothers are processing this family that is kind of a semi-noble family in Russia during a very turbulent time. And they're not sure how to relate to their father. And they all go through very different paths to try to deal with the pain of a father. Their mother had passed away. So they're being raised by this father who acts like a 14-year-old, just always with the women and the booze and everything. And as a young man, there's the main character. My wife is reading it for the first time right now, and she's like, well, this is the guy. Alyosha is the brother that everyone loves, right? He's the hero, right? And I'm like, yeah, he's the one that when I first read this, I was like, that's the guy. He's who I want to be like. But then as you read it, maybe as a dad, you have a totally different set of eyes on this father. You have a totally different sort of thought on, well, what would it be like if I was this father and I was doing that to my kids? Now you start to understand the other two brothers who aren't kind of these holy, devoted, because Alyosha, we open the book and he's in a monastery and totally committed to just seeking God. The other two brothers are kind of going the opposite direction in life. And I just think I understood it differently because of the different place I was in reading it now. And there's this death and resurrection imagery that happens in the book. That's what I wrote my paper on in high school, is all the different characters experience a physical fall and resurrection. And that's kind of like the author highlighting something completely changed in that moment. And so if you read it, you can kind of look for that. And that's my contribution to the literary criticism of Dostoevsky. But I still think, I've always said this was my favorite novel. I think it probably still is. And it's chewy, and I highly recommend it.
Fabulous. It reminds me, this reminds me of, I think I quote this every time we're on the, like we do this podcast, that C.S. Lewis said, you reread books not because the books change, but because you do. And I think really great literature is, you know, you go back in and you're like, oh, I'm seeing this differently because I'm different. Man, I can't tell you how many people have told me to read Brothers Karamazov. I think I started at one point. I think I read the very famous kind of interstitial.
Oh,
the Inquisitor.
Trial of Jesus. So there's a story told in the middle of the book where Jesus returns during the Spanish Inquisition. And the Inquisitor basically says to him, you have no right to be here. We've got things going a certain way. I'm going to kill you in the morning in front of all these people. And it's not because I've lost my faith. It's because you didn't have any right to come here. It's a very interesting little side.
Wow. Brothers K. Let's go.
All right. What else you got, Jeff?
Next one. So Stephen Manuel, you've met. Have you met?
He occasionally co-hosts this podcast, in fact.
Okay, great. He and I were on a work trip, and we were down in Southern California, and we had some time. And so we went to Simi Valley and toured the Ronald Reagan Library, which I've been to before and loved before. But again, you grow up, you get a little older, things look a little different. And so you just see it from a different perspective the older you get. And man, I just plain love Ronald Reagan. I know we're in a very political time right now, and there's a lot of who are political heroes, who are not our political heroes. This guy is a political hero. What this guy set out to do was unbelievable, unbelievable. And they had a setup at the beginning of the Reagan Library. It was very strange. Sometimes they'll do this, I think, to just drum up business. It was about Star Wars, the movie. And so they had all these crazy Star Wars things there. But the idea was, this is a way to get you interested in SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative, which was called Star Wars by the media. And so after we left the museum, I was like, I've got to read some Reagan books. So I read two. I'll give a quick hit on one. The Crusader by Paul Kengor. This book is wonderful. And it makes a very clear case. Kengor's this very conservative, I believe, Catholic writer. He's written a number of books like Reagan and God. And anyway, he's a brilliant scholar, a historical scholar. He writes this book that is Reagan got into office, and one of, if not his primary goal was, I am taking down the Soviet Union. Yes, he wanted to build up the economy because the economy was in shambles. I am taking down the Soviet Union. This thing is evil. And after Reagan was shot shortly after he got into office, he felt almost like a commissioning from God to take down the Soviet Union. And by gum, this guy did it. Don't let anyone convince you otherwise. The Soviet Union didn't just collapse because of internal things. Reagan put his thumb on the scale and made this happen over and over again. The Crusader is a great book about it. He saw it as a crusade, which was the language that drove the Soviets nuts. They would report on it in their media, like, oh, he goes a crusade. Yeah, his crusade was to take them down, take communism down. And as you read the book, in cahoots with the Pope, he did this. So that's The Crusader by Paul Kengor. The book I want to double down on more is adjacent, and it's called Reagan at Reykjavik by Ken Adelman. Ken Adelman was a arms control director for Reagan, brilliant guy. And this book is just about a few days in Reykjavik, Iceland, at this Hofstra house that actually pal Stephen and I visited years and years ago. And it is about the summit between Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev. I just love it because it's nerdy political stuff. It's what the summit was like, how these people are meeting, what's going on in the back rooms as we're trying to strike a deal. This was not supposed to be a big summit between Reagan and Gorbachev. It turned into a huge summit. And the headline is this: at one point, these two guys were about to put on the table, we're abolishing all nuclear weapons right now. And it almost happened. It's got back and forth. Is it going to happen? Is it not going to happen? Political drama. Reagan gets mad and walks out at one point. It's strangely, you might not think this, for me, it was strangely a fun, exciting little read as you're understanding all of the backdrop of what was going on. And really, it's so interesting to me to have lived through the 80s. I lived in the 80s when, as a child, I felt that specter. I felt the shadow of possible nuclear annihilation every day. I lived in fear of the bombs are going to go off and we're all going to be gone. And so maybe it's very specific to me, but I love reading books about that era and what Reagan did to make it to where that never happened. And he took down the Soviet Union. So Reagan at Reykjavik by Ken Edelman alongside The Crusader by Paul Kengor.
I was just thinking about this, Jeff. Maybe this isn't to detract from your book review, but I remember so clearly growing up in the 80s that every military movie that was produced, there was obviously the bad guy was the Russians. My mom remembers nuke drills. She was alive in Texas during the Cuban Missile Crisis when we could basically just like throw nuclear baseballs across the pond and hit with America. But, you know, there was like you said, there was a real threat that the Russians were going to attack us. So there could be nuclear war. And every depiction we made of American heroism in media was anti the Russians, because we were like, they are our enemy and we're going to instill that deep into the bones of Americans.
Rocky IV.
Exactly, Rocky IV. Compare that now. We have a clear political enemy in China. We don't make any Hollywood that villainizes them, or that I was reading about, like all the changes that had to be made. And you're more of a movie guy than I am, but like current Hollywood movies get run by the Communist Party to make sure we don't offend them with our depictions of China if we're doing a movie about war or military conflict or things like that.
Let me throw in a specific here.
Yeah.
Top Gun, the original Top Gun, he had all these patches on his back in the jacket.
That's exactly what I saw.
The new Top Gun, they had to change one of them because it had something to do with Taiwan.
Yeah. And so I'm just going to say, I think we should bring back some, China has a legitimate heavyweight boxer right now who's a contender. Maybe we need a little Rocky. Yeah, maybe not Creed. I am not convinced Michael B. Jordan should be depicting a heavyweight. I think that guy weighs like 170 pounds. But we need a new Rocky IV. I just wish that we would not be quite so afraid to show our enemies in literature or film. But sidebar ended. Another one that you may have read, Jeff, this was my favorite book I read last year. It put itself into my top 10, if not my top 5.
Oh.
And
now, Mark, usually in the past, you're kind of giving me stuff. I'm like, This year, you're giving me nothing but hits.
Yeah. This one is called, have you read this? A Fine Balance by Rohinan Mistry. Rohinan?
Never heard of it.
Okay, so this, if you just Google what's the best Indian novel ever written, this is from India, Rohinan. This is often the book that people will mention. It's a like expansive story that kind of centers on these two guys who travel from the village where they were trained to be tailors, and then bad things start to happen. So they go to New Delhi. And one thing that I have noticed about Indian novels, because after I read this, I just went on a total binge. I've already read 1,000 pages of Indian novels this year, and it's not even the end of January yet that we're recording this. There's no other, for some, there's something about the way Indians write that I'm like so sad when these books are over, because the story is good, but what I really love is hanging out with the people. And that's how I felt, is the two tailors in this book, I just loved hanging out with them. They kind of observe, they're generally content in really miserable circumstances. And I think it added to my appreciation of this book that a couple, 3 or 4 years ago now, our family spent a fair bit of time in New Delhi in India and kind of saw some of the conditions that are described in this book. I will say Indian novels don't have happy endings. And so if you're a person who's like, I'm just looking forward to when they all end up making a lot of money and having nice apartments. I've never read an Indian novel that is, and I've read a bunch of them now. They almost all end in more horrific human suffering than you could have ever come up with on your own. But I loved this book. I thought that the characters are just really well-developed, and there's something about, like, makes you think about contentedness and human nature that I just haven't found in other books. So A Fine Balance, the multi-decade story following two guys who flee from violence in a village, try to make their way as impoverished laborers in India, and eventually whatever happens to them happens. I won't tell you.
I'll point out that one of the benefits of books, and a couple of them you've mentioned, is I think you'd call that kind of book a bildungsroman, is that that's what movies and even TV shows can't accomplish. Which, whenever you see a movie that tries to cover more than 1 year, when it tries to cover decades, it can't do it. It usually, there's a few exceptions. It usually falls short. I think that's one of the benefits of getting into a novel, is you're seeing a longer trajectory and see how it plays out that just cannot be, that can't be expressed in a movie or a TV show.
Yeah. Last night we started an Apple TV series about a book that I just finished that was another 1,000 pager. And I was so infuriated because it's one of these covers lots and lots of years. And there's 11 episodes and it says season one, which makes me think they're going to be, they covered 450 pages in episode one. And I told Amelia, like, they skipped everything that made me love these people. Cause it was another one of those books that I just liked hanging out with the characters. I'm like, now it's a show. I don't even know anything about these people that I'm supposed to be learning. So
what is it? The Foundation?
No, it's called Shantaram. So I don't know if you've read that one, but it's going to be talked about in next year's podcast.
My last big book is 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals by Oliver Berkman. I don't like productivity books. I soured on them because they don't work. They don't do anything. They just sort of, it's a bunch of gurus going, let me tell you what you should do, and you should organize your desk this way and organize your week this way. And I try it and I give up. And this guy used to write for, I think, the New York Times, a column about productivity. And he finally went, you know what? It's all nonsense. And the title of the book, 4,000 Weeks, references the fact that your average Western human lives about 4,000 weeks. And you just have to come to some conclusions about your life. It's kind of philosophical. It's not a believer book, and that's where it really does come short. But it's, you have to come to terms with the fact you are a finite being. there is only so much you're going to accomplish. And productivity books or ideas or podcasts are all about like, you can do it all. And he goes, that is all a bunch of nonsense. And as long as you're constantly in, you know, nobody says that, but if you're in the back of your head thinking, I'm going to accomplish more, you will be doomed to failure. You just have to make smarter decisions around what actually matters. In another one of his books, kind of a follow-up to this one, he quotes Thomas Sowell, who says, there are no such thing as solutions, only trade-offs. And so you've got to be willing to make trade-offs in your life. It means making choices. And for me, it was just so helpful to go, I was really reaching a spot where I was just working and doing things and doing things and doing things and making to-do lists and all of this stuff and feel like none of this matters. Like I'm not getting anywhere. And it was really frustrating to me. And I found more often than not, I was trying to, and I like this phrase he uses, clear the decks. Every day it was just, can I just clear the decks of these things that I need to have done? And it's almost like you're just trying to get to zero. Again, in his follow-up books, it's called Meditations for Mortals. In his follow-up book, he talks about how that's a terrible way to look at yourself. If I'm just getting to zero to justify my existence, that's an awful way to live. And so he talks about a lot of things. He brings it from a number of different perspectives. Be okay with boredom. It's a lot of stuff about being present, even though that's a very threadbare statement. He says, even when we're trying to be productive, that's really a future-focused thing. Like, be, you know, in the moment. He has a great story about an art teacher at Harvard who tells her students, one of the first assignments is, you have to go to a local museum and look at a painting, nothing else, for 3 hours. And so, to some degree, I did that. I went to the local art museum and I sat for 1 hour and looked at a painting for 1 hour. And man, it was really great. It was hard. And I went through all the stages of basically grief that they predicted. You're going to go, this is the wrong painting. I need to check my phone. I need that. But after a while, you push through it and you start to discover things. It's just really fun. This author also talks about doing things just for the sake of enjoying them. Tells this funny story about Rod Stewart, the singer, who is heavy into model trains. Not because he's going to make a nickel off of this or because he's going to be the best model train builder collector in the world. He's like, this is just good for me because it has nothing to do with my career and it's just something I enjoy. I know y'all did a great podcast about the benefits of hobbies for men. And it made me think of that. So there's a lot to this book. He does come up short because he basically goes, you know, and we're all going to die and that's the end. And as believers, we believe obviously in more of we're making deposits now that are going to have an impact on our eternal selves. But I think too much of that thinking can actually turn you into this weird productivity machine that I don't think God wanted us to be. So I'm still processing this book, but for me personally, it's been good medicine here at my midway point of life, I hope, to just reset some things and to go, hey, hyper productivity is not God's goal for you. He wants you to live and exist as a follower of Him. And some of that is just enjoying the life that you have in front of you.
Yeah, I love the optimism that you think you're only halfway through life. And
as a 30-year-old man, I mean, I think that makes sense.
It makes me think about like this observation I've had that if you want to really upset a boomer, tell them they have 10 Christmases left.
I
have said that to people who I actually really love and think, you know, I would want to think this way. I'm like big on the memento mori thing where you kind of want to be very aware that the scripture says God gives a man 70 years or 80 with grace. Now, a lot of us live longer than that nowadays, but I don't think we can count on it. And I think to me that keeping that knowledge front of mind kind of does what you're describing in this book, which is it says, don't waste your time and don't just run the hamster wheel and say, I'll have, you know, 10 or 15 good years at the end of it. Cause like my father-in-law kind of pursued some things that he probably didn't enjoy, but it was like, well, we're going to get over here. And then he had a much, much shorter life than he expected. And I just think sometimes keeping in mind the finite nature of our human experience on this earth, actually can add to life. But I've found that a lot of people don't think that way, and they get very upset when you tell them, you're going to die very, very soon. So keep that in mind, please.
No wonder your clients love you.
Yeah. That's the end of your big books recommendations.
Those are my books.
I'm gonna go quick hit style for the rest because I don't have a lot to share on these, but I think they're worth a mention. Have you heard of Barbara Kingsolver?
Yes.
Is she like an airport novel writer mostly?
No, she had written her big book was The Poisonwood Bible that was both popular and well regarded. And I have a feeling you're headed towards Demon Copperhead.
Maybe it's because of her name. I just never thought I would read a book by a Barbara, but I did. I read Demon Copperhead, which is a modern American Appalachian retelling of David Copperfield. And it's really good. My wife just read David Copperfield and she's like, she has gotten way more endurance with thick literature than I do. And she's like, this one took effort to get through. But I didn't feel that way about Demon Copperhead. If you enjoy the J.D. Vance Hillbilly Elegy, just kind of thinking about that part of America, and then you might really like Demon Copperhead, which is a fictional story, but kind of explores a lot of the same themes about what's happening in this part of our country where there's a whole lot of narcotics and poverty. And it's almost, maybe I just have a penchant for misery novels because it kind of reminds me of some of the things I like about the Indian novels too. But I liked it. Did you read it, Jeff?
No, my wife did. She liked it, but she said it was very rough. Like there's a lot of hard stuff in it.
Yeah, if she felt that way about Demon Copperhead, she would probably be vomiting into the trash can if she read A Fine Balance, because takes rough to a new level. Next one I wanted to quickly mention, this one I read at the recommendation of Virgil from the Just Thinking podcast, a guy that we like.
We love him.
Check in on. It's called Up From Slavery. It's the kind of autobiography of Booker T. Washington. And Virgil said that he was sitting in the airport and heard a bunch of young people talking about some of the kind of woke race books that they had read, and they were trying to figure out, what do we think about race relations in the U.S.? And like, we're trying to read stories of African American people and understand their perspective. And he walked over and he's like, you should read Up From Slavery by Booker T. Washington, because he was a slave who lived right at the time of emancipation and then started a school in Tuskegee, Alabama, for recently emancipated slaves primarily. And it was really interesting because his response to some of the low expectations that were being placed on emancipated slaves was to create an environment where expectations were much higher than what they would be if this was a school for white kids. And the fruit was undeniably good from his life. And I have a feeling that he would say to kind of places where society now goes to people who have been put at disadvantages historically for whatever reason, Booker T. Washington would say, yeah, we need to expect more from those people because they're capable of it. And anything less than that is treating them like they're dumb. And so I really liked the book, and his story is fascinating just as a story, but then there's a lot of things to take away.
My oldest daughter is about to read that for school, and I'm going to read it along with her.
Yeah, I think it's enjoyable. Last couple that I'll mention, Silence by Shusaku Endo. Have you read this book, Jeff?
No, but didn't you mention that last year on the last year's podcast?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, sorry. Maybe you said you were going to read it.
Okay. I read it.
Another happy-go-lucky.
It's interesting to me to read books that are written by like totally different cultures. And this one was written in Japanese. It's about Japan. It's about missionaries that go to Japan during a time when they were killing missionaries in Japan. And if you want, just again, it's not a happy story, but it'll make you think about what does devotion look like. And even what is the difference between religion and belief? Because the title Silence comes from the main protagonist kind of asking God, where are you? It looks like you're gone. Are you silent? So there's definitely Job themes in there. And I enjoyed that one. The last one I was going to just mention, if you're looking for kind of a New York Times bestseller that also won the Pulitzer Prize, so it's kind of it's a fun story, and it's got some kind of literary value. I read The Orphan Master's Son by Adam Johnson, which is a story. It's different stories of the same guy who kind of changes personality and even changes his name as the story goes on. Really, really interesting story about kind of North Korea. This guy goes from work camps to becoming assuming the identity of one of the leaders of the North Korean Communist Party, and then eventually back to almost enslavement and work camps. And so it's a really interesting story. My wife loves North Korea stories, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. She's like very interested in how is there this whole people group that is living a totally different experience with no access to truth. So she put me on it, and I thought it was really good. So The Orphan Master's Son, it's kind of a fun page turner that also, like I said, has some pretty interesting themes in it.
For your wife, a Kim Jong-un production, that's a great book. It's a crazy story about North Korea kidnapping. This is a true story. North Korea kidnapping the South Korean director and actress. Do you know this book?
Yeah, yeah. I've heard of the story.
Oh, read the book. It's great.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really great. Hey, two quick ones before we leave. I said I didn't have any more, but hey, for your listeners who listen to books, you can get this on Audible. It was made for Audible. It's not quite a book. It's more of like a little podcast thing, but it is a book. It's called, and I listened to it twice, the whole series twice. My wife listened to it once. We loved it. True story. It's called Mother, Neighbor, Russian Spy. It's about a woman who moves to America, and she is a Russian spy and raises her children. I'm telling you, my wife, she don't like spy stuff like I do. She was so engrossed in this story about how a mom could actually be a spy raising her kids in America. Super fun listen.
I'm putting that on the list right now.
It's super great. Rosamund Pike. She narrates it. You got interviews. So it's not quite a book because you're hearing interviews and all this. It's great. True actually happened. So real quick, two last ones to throw out. Bad Therapy by Abigail Schreier and the Jonathan Haidt book, The Anxious Generation. It would be hard to talk about 2024 and not mention both of those books. I think both of those books are incredibly important, especially for parents. I know y'all have talked about these on the podcast, so I think we just need to high five those books on our way out.
Yeah, 100% agree. If you haven't read at least Bad Therapy, but Anxious Generation, is that the one you're talking about?
Yes.
With Jonathan Haidt. Both of those books I think of as like you're in dereliction of duty as a parent if you haven't read them. And so read them. I've bought them for members of the school board that I'm a part of. And I think they're really helpful for anybody who interacts with youth at all. So Jeff, thanks for being a part of now our fourth annual Best Books of the Year podcast. If you guys are interested in any of the books we talked about, we'll put links to those books. Thanks for listening, Jeff. Thanks for really, I know that you spent a whole year reading so that you'd be prepared for this. And
it was really just in the last week. I was like, right, we're going to do a podcast. I better read some books.
So that's all we've got this week. Like I said at the start, I just want you guys to think about picking up a book here and there. Don't forget about intellectual capital. It does not have to be the stuff that Jeff and I like to read. We like to give you those in case you need ideas. But for the most part, we just want you to continue developing your minds. And I think reading books is a great way to do that. So thanks for checking it out. And I hope this episode is a blessing to you. We'll see you next week. And as always, Here at Abraham's Wallet, it's our goal to help you run your home and your dough like a biblical boss.